from WRAL-FM and Capital Broadcasting. Welcome to Wine and Dandy. I'm your host, Sarah King.
I'm your host, Jamie Caskey. We're here to show you wine is fun. We intend to prove it.
And today we're totally going to prove it because we're talking about one of our favorite subjects. It's Sophie Barrett. She works for Tall River Wine Man with my husband. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. I, too, love, love, love sparkling wine.
You were just telling us that you have a title. You are officially a sales rep for Hall River Rhineman,
yes.
The distributor.
Yes.
But you have a fun title that you can also claim.
Yes, I am known as a Friend of Bubbles.
Who gave you that name?
It was given to me by my friends at Transatlantic Bubbles, a small Connecticut-based champagne importer that I had a very close professional relationship with while I lived in New York. As a buyer up there, I got to go on their champagne trip a lot. And then... after I stopped being a buyer and started being basically a direct competitor, I was still invited on their champagne trip.
Because you're a good time.
Yeah. So we would, and because I speak French, which none of them did. So it was partly translation. But a lot of it was just because I had been sort of grandfathered into this trip to Champagne every year. So even though I was standing as a direct competitor to them, I was still traveling with them to Champagne. And we were going to tastings that required a name tag. And so everyone had the name of their company that they worked for on their name tag. And so they just went with Friend of Bubbles because I was obviously working for a competitor.
Oh my God, I love it.
It's nice that they stayed so inclusive. We too would like to be friends with Transatlantic Bubbles. I feel like they're A, really nice people, and B, take you on some pretty cool trips.
They are wonderful, wonderful people to know. Sadly, I was supposed to travel with them to Champagne a few weeks ago, and I elected not to go because it was the middle of the Omicron surge. And under other circumstances, I would have been happy to be stranded in Champagne for a long period of time, but it just was not going to work out January.
So. You have a young child, too. It's never good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, today we are delving into the world of bubbles and all the different types of bubbles.
This is a real hardship for Sarah.
I'm so sad today is happening.
Today we're going to be talking about different styles of bubbles and what you need to know to kind of help navigate a selection in a wine list or on a shelf in a store.
Basically, you're demystifying champagne.
I mean, I hope to. I am very, interested as a professional in helping people make better choices at the store and in the restaurant.
Well, you know, if there's anybody in the world who's going to be able to do it, it's going to be Sophie.
Yeah, I think people do get intimidated, especially if they think, ooh, I'd like a little something festive, but I don't want to embarrass myself.
Yeah, or I would like something festive, but I don't want to spend a ton of money. And the fact is, with a little bit of information, you can get a really nice bottle of wine at the price you want, in the style that you want, without embarrassing yourself. So I always think people are far away from answering the question that is the most important, namely, do I like this? You know, as long as you're answering that question when you taste a wine, you're doing, basically all the most important work. So.
Oh, I love that. That's a little long for a t-shirt, but I really like that.
So I have the first question I have to ask you is something that bothers me. Does your eye twitch like mine does when someone refers to any sparkling wine as champagne?
Certainly, yes, it does.
Okay, good.
Yeah, it does. It does.
My eye is twitching. My eye's been twitching for about a week. And when you started that question, I thought, is she going to talk about my eye twitching?
No, it's not about you, Jamie.
Hippity-hoppity along over here. Sorry. So tell everybody, just in case they haven't heard us say this a million times, what true champagne is.
True champagne is sparkling wine that comes from the Champagne region of France.
The end.
Yeah, that's it. That's what champagne is.
What makes champagne different, aside from location, from other sparkling wines?
Well, the biggest thing that makes champagne different is actually not the method, but the terroir, the place that it's made. Champagne is really far north. It's extremely cold. That turns out to be essential to the way that the wines are made and the way that they taste. They have a particular soil type, which is, it's basically Kimmeridgian limestone, but with a lot of chalk. And so a lot of people, when they speak about the taste of champagne, they speak about chalkiness and chalky flavors.
Yeah.
Really, the only other place that that's found in the world of sparkling wine is on the southern coast of England, where they now make some sparkling wine. But that's actually quite close to Champagne, and they share, you know, some similarities of terroir. But that would not be considered Champagne because it's from England. You really have to be within the Champagne region of France to be making a proper Champagne.
That leads me to my next question, which is, you know, you said it's a very cold place. With climate change, is that affecting champagne at all?
For sure. I mean, climate change is affecting every winemaking region in the world. It is just the truth. I think there's probably an argument to be made that the warming up of champagne has produced some very, very, very good wines. And so even though we do not overall like the effects of climate change on wine, in champagne, it has some perceptible benefits. places that basically really struggled to get ripe in the past are now getting pretty ripe naturally. So that in turn reduces the amount of sugar that you then need to use in the wine to get the balance that you want. Because basically ripeness is just development of sugar in the grapes.
Right.
I mean, speaking specifically about Champagne, the combination of riper grapes and better winemakers has resulted in some really, really good wines in what I would consider like the post beginning of climate change era.
Let's take a quick break, and then I have a question for you about enforcement. Welcome back to Wine and Dandy, where we are with the bubbles expert. Sophie, we've been talking about how only sparkling wines from Champagne can be called Champagne. How do they enforce that? Because, I mean, you'll hear all over the world people are using similar grapes for a different style of a particular wine. How is Champagne different?
In terms of like enforcing what's on the label, that's really hard to do. The way that the word champagne got co-opted by sparkling wines from other parts of the world was by basically writing champagne method. And so by writing champagne method, these wines are made in the style of champagne. You were saying this is champagne-like, but it's not from Champagne.
And elaborate on what the champagne method is.
So the champagne method is the specific way that sparkling wine is made in Champagne. It is basically revolves around the process of a second fermentation where you make the base wine, you ferment it, and then you put into the bottle a little bit of sugar and a little bit of yeast, and you basically start a second fermentation in the bottle. Champagne requires that second fermentation to take place over a large period of time in a freezing cold cellar. Mm-hmm. Again, back to the temperature there.
Okay.
Typically has longer like regulations on how much time the wine needs to spend in its second fermentation process.
And how long is it? You say it's a large amount of time.
It's 18 months to 2 years for like a regular champagne. Mm-hmm. But then it's 4 years for a vintage champagne or like a Brut Reserve or something like that.
Like a Dom Perignon. How much is that?
Oh,
my
gosh.
Is it super expensive?
Yeah. Dom Perignon is a... I'm sorry. I actually don't know that much about the larger champagne houses, but it's a long time. I mean, it would be... I would think, like, their current release is probably, like, in the 2010s, I would say.
Oh, wow.
So indicating that it might have spent, you know, up to, like, 8 years or something in the process of the second fermentation.
So the price is affected then by how long it's in that second fermentation.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, for sure. Exactly. So yeah, with kind of prestige cuvées, a lot of the price is connected to how long it took to make it, because as long as it's sitting in your cellar, you're not selling it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Right.
So basically you're paying for that really, really long, slow process that rewards the drinker with like the finest bubbles and the most complex expression. Ah. So there's certainly a reason to pay for it.
And you mentioned fine bubbles, and I would imagine because the longer it sits in there, the more bubbles are created by the bacteria. And that makes smaller bubbles, right?
Yeah, smaller bubbles, a finer texture. It increases the yeasty flavors. So yeastiness or like toastiness or brioches, and those are other flavor associates with champagne. And it is because of that long, slow process where basically we're making bubbles in the bottle and we're getting autolysis flavors, which are basically yeasty flavors.
Look at you, fancy big word.
I know. She's probably good at Scrabble.
Oh, I'm terrible at Scrabble.
I am too. I can't spell to save my life.
You get a Wordle, which is my current obsession.
Mine too. Did you get today's?
No, they're always hard. I get to my third try and I'm like, I hate this. And then I text my son and he gives me a hint. I'm cheating.
You are 100% cheating. Work your brain, sis.
And yet I've had a really rough beginning of the year. So I feel
that's true, you have.
Even putting five letters down on paper is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I digress. What were you going to ask?
I was going to ask you, you know, since you're putting sugar in yeast, which makes the yeast eats the sugar, which in case you don't know, then they fart out the gas and that's where the bubbles come from. I'm just going to say it as it is. Do bottles ever blow up?
They do not.
Really? How do they keep that from happening? You would think.
That's a really good question. I mean, they usually use a crown cap during the second fermentation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they will typically have the bottles slanted at an angle with the neck of the bottle and the crown cap at the bottom. And then
the bubbles rise.
Yeah. And then they'll do the riddling, which is where you twist the bottle, to allow the deposit to float all the way into the neck of the bottle. They really don't have explosions. I mean, I imagine if you shook up the bottle and agitated it, you could get an explosion.
You really wanted one. Sure.
That's a lot for the quality of glass and champagne.
Well, the glass
is
always thicker. Yeah. But I mean, those you know, the corks and the cages that they eventually put around the champagne, the champagne bottles, like those are there for a reason. I mean, those are there to make sure that you don't get an explosion. I will tell you what is very explosive is the process of disgorgement.
I'm sorry, what?
So disgorgement, this is actually, this is a great word to know actually in talking about champagne. Okay. Disgorgement is when you take off the crown cap, shoot out the little deposit of dead yeast cells, and then recork it with the cork you're going to use and put the cage on the top. And
this
that
is not
process
done by hand, is it?
Well, some people do it by hand.
They want to lose an eye.
No doubt.
I mean, I've seen a lot of hand disgorgements. Tiny producers will sometimes disgorge their entire production, but what is more common is some kind of assembly line where the disgorgement is done by a machine.
I can't imagine being able fast enough. Okay, so I have one more question. Oh, actually, I have two, but one is, why is champagne so renowned throughout the world?
Well, champagne really did a good job marketing its wares like toward the end, middle of the 19th century. It became associated with prestige sparkling wine that became very, very, very popular. They had a good method for making it, and they had a big market, and it really became associated with luxury and, you know, fine experiences. It was really a marketing thing in the 19th century that made that possible.
Hmm. Well, my last one is, before we get into this wine, and maybe I can ask you this later, but I'm going to ask you now. You're an expert in wine, right?
Yeah.
More than most.
Yeah, I know a lot about wine. Yeah, I'd say that.
Do you ever find yourself, like I do when I'm at Wegmans or at, like, you know, Harris Teeter, wanting to help people who look desperately lost in the wine section? Because I know I do.
Yes.
And do you actually do it, or you just want to?
Yeah, occasionally I'll do it. Yeah. I mean, in Wegmans, I do it pretty often because they never have enough people working on the floor there, and I go there to merchandise the products I sell.
Buy our wine.
So whenever I see, because I was in wine retail for a long, long, long time, and when I see people looking lost in a wine section, it makes me really sad because
I feel
that a person should be on deck to steer the person toward what they're looking for.
I feel the same. I'm always like, I could help you. And then I'm like, I'm there so often, it would be too often for me to be helping someone.
They think you work there.
Just what are you looking for? What do you like? Are you a Syrah fit? Oh, Syrah. Okay. And then like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What do you want to spend? What area do you like it from? You could totally do that.
Yeah. Well, I have done it. I used to work in a wine store.
No, I mean, you could totally do that at Wegmans.
I could.
Yeah.
Only if they gave me a discount. Anyway, we digress. Let's take another short break, and then we'll get into tasting wine. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Wine and Dandy Podcast. We would love to hear from you and answer any questions that you have. Sophie Barrett's here. She is the friend of Bubbles, also a wine expert and wine salesperson for the Hall River Wine Man, which is where my husband works. So what are we tasting today?
Well, I brought two different bottles of wine today that I think are going to be an interesting, conversation topics, but also delicious to drink.
That's the most important part, Sophie. She's pulling them out of her insulated bag.
Yes, yes. You'll have to excuse me. One of them I opened yesterday to give a couple of my customers a taste, and then I sold some. So hopefully that will not be a deal breaker for you guys.
I have to say, this thing that you have recorked the champagne bottle with is a heifer cork.
Yep.
What on earth? May I see that?
Yes. Well, that is another reason why I thought that it might be fun to have one that was already under a closure, because these things can be really, really, really useful. It's a champagne stopper. I recommend that anybody that takes more than a casual interest in drinking sparkling wine get one of these.
Oh, at least one.
So most people will tell me, oh, but I don't have trouble, you know, taking the bottle to the dome and there's not going to be any left over. And it's like, yeah, you know, totally. But what if there's like a glass left over, you know? And these things work so well. And champagne and sparkling wines in general stay good open in the fridge really well. And so I just strongly recommend, they're going to hold up better than a Sauvignon Blanc, like better than a Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
Like, you know, get one of these and just don't feel like you have to, you know, finish the bottle in a
sitting. I just want to say thank you for giving me a new term, take it to the dome. Love it.
That's very interesting, because I have always thought that if you open a bottle of sparkling wine or champagne, that's it. That girl gone.
Well, that is a popular misconception. And I think one of the reasons is that it is impossible to get the original cork back into the bottle.
Oh, yeah,
because
impossible.
They like are all flayed out and stuff like that.
Right.
So you really need to have one of these. And I will say, especially champagne, because if you think about that long, slow second fermentation, the bubbles are like knit into the fabric of the wine and they are not going anywhere. And you can leave a bottle of good champagne open in the fridge without even a champagne stopper in it for a couple days. And
can
it'll
you
stay
really?
Bubbly. Yes. These wines have so much structure that they will stay open for several days.
We don't recommend you leave it open in your fridge. You should have one of these great stoppers.
Yeah, exactly. But if you did, you might be surprised to find
how many
bubbles will still be in the bottle.
This has just totally rocked my world. And I love how you said the bubbles are knit into the fabric.
I felt the same.
Yes, it's so true, because this is one of the things that a person notices when tasting the different styles of sparkling wine. I think you were saying, Sarah, we were starting to ask about that, you know, the different styles of sparkling wine,
right,
and specifically the champagne method. So the champagne method makes a stronger bubble, essentially. Like it makes a finer bubble, but it makes a stronger bubble. So Prosecco, which we're also going to be tasting, is made in a tank with a forced carbonation. Mm-hmm. And that will not create as like strong a bubble. And so you are going to lose more in a Prosecco or in a wine made using the Charmant method, which is that tank fermentation, mm-hmm, than you will in a wine that has undergone like a proper second fermentation.
Okay, so
I definitely don't want to say that to knock Prosecco, though, because Prosecco is a great beverage and there are lots of good ones and it has a wonderful place in our like drinking lives. And I absolutely am totally smitten by the bottle of Prosecco that I brought today. And so, you know, we'll definitely, you know, talk about what's great about Prosecco too and other kinds of sparkling wine.
All right, well, let's get to tasting.
Sure.
So what should we taste first? I see that you're opening a wee tiny half bottle of champagne.
Yes, I'm opening a wee tiny half bottle of champagne because I figured, you know, we probably didn't need, take a whole bottle to the three of our domes this morning. This is a champagne from the Champagne region of France. It is a Grand Cru. It is from the Grand Cru of Cremant.
What does Grand Cru mean, just for those who don't know?
Grand Cru is the best vineyard sites. And the confusing thing about Grand Cru is that it can mean different things in different regions of France. But
fabulous.
At the basic level, what it means is these are the best vineyards.
Okay.
This wine is made out of Chardonnay. The Grand Cru of Cremant is in the Côte Blanc. So the Côte Blanc makes Chardonnay-based champagnes. They're not always 100%, but they are typically majority Chardonnay.
What kind of grapes typically go into champagne? What are the choices? Because I know it's regulated.
Yes, very much so. Champagne has a regulating body called the CIVC that's one of the most strict in the winemaking world. So champagne has a crap load of regulations on it. They are very interested in preserving the prestige of the product that they have made and marketed around the world. So there are a lot of controls on champagne, a lot more than in most other regions.
And so what are the grapes that they use in
So there? The three main champagne grapes are Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier. Chardonnay is a white grape variety. Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier are both red grape varieties. Typically in Champagne, those red grapes will ultimately manifest as a white wine because the grape juice is pressed directly off the skins, mm-hmm, not allowing any time for maceration, which would give the wine color.
I know this. I'm just going to add this while you pop that baby open, that if you see Blanc de Blancs, that means it's champagne made from white grapes.
Yeah.
And Blanc de Noir, which is made from the red grapes.
Yeah. Blanc de Blanc is a lot more common than Blanc de Noir. Most champagne producers in like the Grand Crus of the Montagne de Reims, which is where the most prestigious Pinot Noir-based champagnes come from, are using a little bit of Chardonnay in their blends. Blanc de Noir is actually quite rare, but it's really, really delicious. And I encourage everyone who is excited about champagne to try a Blanc de Noir.
Now, I'm watching you open this bottle because what I have heard, and you can confirm or deny, is you hold the cork, twist the bottle.
So this happens a lot where like I grab the bottom of my shirt and I wrap the bottom of my shirt around the top of the wine, because it's really important to hold it slowly and do it slowly, because doing it fast, whether you twist the cork or the bottle, doing it fast is what's going to give you a lot of wine all over the place. And that can be fun on the porch, but I don't want to do that in your lovely studio.
Well, our engineer appreciates that.
I always do it if I'm doing sparkling, I do a dish towel over the top and do it, twist the bottle slowly. And that is what I had heard probably from Sarah.
That's what I have always found to work. Of course, if the bottle has been agitated, it's going to make a big explosion no matter how slowly you do
and
it.
And don't invite that person back, guys,
yeah,
if someone's
seriously
agitated your champagne.
I have a life goal involving champagne, which is to use a sword to open one.
Oh, my nephew can do that. He doesn't even drink wine typically, but he knows how to do that.
Does he have a sword lying around?
He uses a very large kitchen knife.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, you can do it with a kitchen knife. I will be trying this weekend.
That's really funny because I just did my first sabering adventure a couple of weeks ago with my best friend Susanna. And we literally sabered a bottle of Lambrusco that we couldn't get open with a butter knife on her porch. And it was hilarious.
A butter knife?
Yes, we sabered it with a butter knife because the cork was really in there and we couldn't get it open any other way.
Lambruscos are especially hard to get out. That's something I've noticed as a person who used to sell a lot of wine and open it at tables when I served is that Lambrusco and Prosecco both have really hard corks to get out.
Yep.
Okay, so tell everybody again what we're drinking. Mm.
Okay, this is the Guy Larmandier Cremant Grand Cru. It is Blanc de Blanc, so it's 100% Chardonnay, and it is Brut Zero. So Brut Zero refers to the amount of dosage that's in the bottle. Dosage is something that is added after the disgorgement at the time of bottling, or at the time of corking, exactly. And it's a little bit of sugar or grape must that is added to balance the wine and to get the desired sweetness level that the producer is looking for. So Brut Zero is no sugar added at that stage. Now, it's important. It's not no sugar added at all, because to get the second fermentation, you have to have a little bit of sugar added along with the yeast.
Right, right.
So no sugar added after the disgorgement.
It's funny because to me, it smells very sweet.
Well, to that, I would say grapes have been getting riper in Champagne. And going back to our conversation about, you know, climate change, there's been a lot more interest in making Brut Nature and drier champagnes because the grapes are getting riper. It used to be when, you know, the grapes weren't really getting ripe that you really did need sugar, because otherwise your wine would just be so sour. I mean, Champagne gets some of the raciest acid in the winemaking world, probably paralleled only by German Riesling in terms of like how much acid is actually in there.
Gotcha.
So really aggressive acidity and bone dry can be a little off-putting, you know, even for people who are like really into that, like me. You know, you need to be eating oysters or something like that, you know, or else it can be just a little too much. And so
a little bitey.
I get lemon.
Yes,
I get a lot of lemon.
Super citrusy. But again, this is speaking to the climate that we're in. We're in northern France. It's very cold. Mm-hmm. Chardonnay is a blank slate. It will taste like where you plant it and what you do to it.
Oh.
So this is a very cold region. You're going to get those lemony notes. You're going to get this sort of chalkiness. I really love this wine. I think it's really, really, really nicely balanced, even with no added sugar.
Let's test it.
Let's check it.
Let's do it. Mm, that'll do. That's so good.
That's very lovely. Wow, it's not every day we get to have this, I can tell you.
Well, I'm going to be leaving it with you guys, so I hope you I hope you'll enjoy it later on today or whenever
you like.
Or,
you know, like right after this.
To say it, the bubbles were so fine, I hardly even tasted them.
Mm, yeah.
This is, just out of curiosity, retail, what would a regular size bottle of this run you?
$60-$70
Well, ding, dang, dong, I must say. This is, again, not something we have every day.
Yeah. And if you're in a restaurant, times that number by four.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. The bubbles are so tiny.
Yeah, the bubbles are tiny.
Super tiny. And Cremant, I heard once that Cremant means creamy. Is that right?
You're saying Cremant, and this bottle of wine is from Cremant. So let's talk about that, because this is confusing to so many people. The word Cremant, which is spelled C-R-E-M-A-N-T.
Yes.
That refers to a wine that is made using the Champagne method in another part of France. Cremant d'Alsace, Cremant de Jura, Cremant de Bourgogne. Those are all sparkling wines made using the Champagne method in parts of France that are not Champagne. Cremant, on the other hand, is a Grand Cru in the Côte Blanc. It is confusing.
So is the only difference that first vowel then?
Yeah, the first vowel is the only difference.
A is the region, E is the method elsewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was delicious.
It was delicious.
Good.
I loved it. And
yeah,
I mostly get like lemon. I don't get like brioche or anything on this.
And I, you know what?
This is not super toasty. Probably has not been on the lees for too terribly long, because as you can see from the cork, we have 2017 here. So entirely possible that you would get more of those brioche notes from a wine that had spent longer in its second fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
We should also check and see when this was disgorged.
Okay.
Disgorged on the 15th of July in 2021. So that would be not a very long time post-disgorgement. Mm-hmm. So it makes a huge difference whether the aging is done as part of the second fermentation with the wine still on its yeast or aged in the bottle after disgorgement, because it speeds up the aging a lot to have it already disgorged.
Oh,
it's part of the thing that's so magical about this process of making champagne is that when the wine is on the lees, we say, on its yeast in the bottle, not yet disgorged, the yeast basically acts as a preservative, and the wine can age for a really long time.
Good to know.
Like decades.
Okay, so if you were buying champagne as an investment, you would look for wine that has not been disgorged.
Yes, I would look for, I always think the disgorgement date is super important to check, because if you're looking for a really fresh style like this is, you will want it to have been disgorged relatively recently, like within the past year or two. if you're looking for like a savory wine with lots of umami notes and mushroomy and oxidative, a wine with, you know, 10 years post-disgorgement is going to be totally fine. The bubbles will be basically non-existent, but the wine will still have a lot of flavor. So okay. It makes a big difference whether it was in the bottle before disgorgement or after. And now we're going to try a Prosecco. Prosecco is a large region in the northeastern part of Italy in the Veneto. As we discussed earlier, they have a different style of making sparkling wine there.
The grape is different too. I think it's the Galera.
Yes, you got it.
Job.
You got it. Galera is the great grape of Prosecco.
Okay. Oh, I like it.
Whoa!
Check this out. So it's good that we did this because you can see. So I poured this wine for probably four people yesterday, corked it up with this thing. So much of the carbonation is retained by using this.
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully you guys heard that, but if not, it sounded like she shot someone.
So here we are. We have a glass full of Prosecco.
It smells terrific. It's a much, I think, lighter note. Oh, it's almost like a rose that isn't over scented.
Galera is an aromatic grape variety, and often you will get some of those florals on the nose with Prosecco, which is great. Again, back to the point of like, you know, there's no like champagne is expensive and prestigious. Prosecco is also wonderful and a lot more accessible price wise, and often a lot more accessible in the flavor profile as well.
And yeah, speak to if you would, because a lot of people hear Prosecco and they think, ugh, so sweet.
Yeah, a lot of times it is sweet.
Mm-hmm. That's totally wrong on so many levels because there is such a range. Speak to that if you would.
Well, yeah, that was actually one of the things that I most wanted to talk about today was the range of sweetnesses that are possible within sparkling wine and how to make it a little bit more clear, like to the buyer, kind of what you're getting. So Brut is the most common designation, and Brut is supposed to be between 5 grams and like 12 or 14 grams of sugar in the bottle. That's a fairly like prescribed amount of sugar for that designation. Brut means dry, though, so we've got sugar in the bottle, but we're still considering it to be a dry wine. And a lot of that is because all sparkling wines that are good have a crap load of acidity in them, right? And so you can have 12 grams of sugar in a wine, and if your pH is like under 3, the wine is still going to taste quite dry.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. So if someone were looking for a not sweet Prosecco, they would look for Brut.
I would say look for Brut, yeah.
And so if they are looking for a sweet Prosecco, it shouldn't say Brut on the label.
If it doesn't say Brut on the label, it's probably a decently good indication that it's got some sweetness to it. This particular wine, actually part of the reason that I chose to bring it, so we're tasting the Belle Casselle Assolo Prosecco Superiore Extra Dry.
Ah, good.
So, but Extra Dry is sweeter than Brut.
Hold on.
Yes. This is really confusing.
You just broke Jamie.
I know. But this the breaking is going to lead to greater understanding and demystification. Okay.
Give it to us.
So Brut is the standard, right? And Brut means dry. On the drier side of Brut, we have Extra Brut.
Okay.
And then on the drier side of Extra Brut, we have Brut Zero or Brut Nature, which means no sugar has been added at all.
So you said before that Brut is drier than Extra Brut?
Brut is sweeter than Extra Brut.
Okay, got it.
Oh,
but
is that opposite?
But Brut is drier than Extra Dry. That's where the confusion comes in.
So there's Extra Dry, Brut,
yes.
So Extra Brut, Brut Zero.
Yes. So we have Brut in the middle, and then on the drier side, we have Extra Brut.
Okay.
And on the sweeter side, we have Extra Dry. But my point in bringing a Prosecco that is categorized as Extra Dry is to show that there is yet a sweeter, fruitier style that's still really balanced and really delicious, and that if you are a person who enjoys a slightly sweeter wine, you should not feel embarrassed about that. You should rather feel empowered to be able to pick out one of those and enjoy it.
Nice job, girl.
We're all about empowerment. Cheers to that.
Yeah, I'm like the idea. Okay, so Italians drink a ton of champagne. Italians love bubbles. They also have a great appreciation for lightly sweet bubbles. And so, you know, it would be ridiculous to hold Prosecco to the standards of champagne. It's its own category.
Right.
And within that, a lot of pleasure to be delivered along a spectrum from quite dry to a little bit sweeter.
Okay. Well, I just took a sip because I couldn't have it.
She can't stand it. She's around a bubble. Got to be in her mouth.
It's my favorite. The bubbles are not nearly as tight as the Cremant Grand Cru Guy Larmandier. Is that how you say it?
Larmandier.
Yeah.
You were very close.
I was trying.
You did
really
great.
Hard.
You did great.
Thank you. I would definitely say this is more approachable.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, I was going to say, I actually prefer this, although I like both of them very much.
You're not going to throw the champagne out of bed for eating crackers?
Nope. Again, like, there's so many different styles of sparkling wine to enjoy. Mm. I think this is absolutely delicious, too. So a couple of weeks ago, you know, I've been with Hall River for almost 3 years. I had never sampled a bottle of this wine because I was afraid because it said extra dry on the label. And I'm a snob, and I like dry champagne. So I'm thinking, like, oh my God, this is going to be so sweet, blah, blah, blah. I was so snobby about it. And it was Eddie, Sarah's husband, who said, oh, that wine is freaking delicious. You got to get that in the
bag.
Shout
out to Eduardo.
Got it in the bag, sold some immediately, and have been championing it ever since because it is so delicious. And there is no, like, you know, it's got to be dry to be good.
And I just want to speak to the strength of these bottles. This is a side story. I went to the warehouse where they keep all their wine as a favor to Eddie on my way back on a trip to pick up some wine for a client. Bella Cassell was one of the wines, and so I tried to carry it back to the car while your boss, Jim, carried some others. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I dropped the whole case down the stairs. Ooh. It rolled like four times. I was mortified. I was like, oh, my God. Not a single bottle broke, though.
Dang.
Strong bottle of wine right here,
yeah.
Y'all.
Mm-hmm. So how much would this, since you said Proseccos are, in terms of a cost point, probably more approachable than champagne
right.
from champagne, how much would this bottle run you retail,
like
roughly?
$16, $17.
That's
what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. You have a significantly better value for still a very good wine.
It's delicious.
Although both are great.
That is a conversation that's been hatched in many a wine geek sphere, is the how many bottles of really good Cremant or Prosecco could I have for one bottle of X, like super prestigious champagne. Mm-hmm. And it's a totally valid argument. The counter argument is really, in my opinion, only that people who want champagne and who want that flavor profile will not be satisfied by anything else.
Right.
Because there is not anything else that tastes like champagne.
Plus, they tend to want champagne on the label. It needs to say champagne, right.
Hence the popularity of Clicquot Yellow Label, probably the best-selling champagne of all time.
Also started by a lady, Madame Clicquot.
Yeah.
Well, I think that we've covered it. This has been fascinating and delicious.
I was going to say, and delicious. And it's so nice for people to have an idea now of, A, some options, and the fact that you can leave that bad boy, I mean, you can open a bottle of champagne.
Paradigm shifting.
Yeah, exactly. Sarah's like, my entire refrigerator plan has changed.
Yes, I need way more room for way more bubbles.
And that glass or two on the second day may be even better than they were on the first day.
This is like casserole or lasagna.
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
Totally.
Sure. Okay.
That really means that a Magnum is the right size, right? Because you need 100%? A bottle for the first night, but then you need a bottle for the second
night. That's a super good point. Sophie, thank you so much. And thanks to Hall River Wine Man. And women for coming out and bringing your wares to us.
Yes.
You're welcome. I had such a good time being here. Thank you guys so much for having me. This was a blast. I'm glad you like the wine.
Buy some bubbles, and you don't have to drink it all in one day. You can.
Or, as the French say, santé.
Santé.
Santé.